Leon Cooperman. It just goes on and on. Started his own hedge fund, had to close it in 2015 because of a bout with cancer. Thankfully, that's gone away. He's now opening his new fund. You can Google it at Seabreeze Partners LP, or just Google Doug Cass and Seabreeze Partners. He'll be opening, is launching his new fund, long short. Not much to say about a legend, but you are the legend. Writes at realmoney.com, thestreet.com. I read it religiously every week. You've been on fire. You've got two special guests. Doug, I'm turning it over to you. Get me out of here.
Thanks, John, for the nice introduction. Byron, Jerry, and I have been friends for decades, and we have a great deal of mutual respect. I duel with Byron in our annual surprise list, and I talk almost daily to Jerry about individual stocks and ideas. Our families are engaged socially. So today I'm here to introduce you to two investment icons, one a trader, the other a strategist, but they both have several common threads. One could easily argue that Jerry Jordan is the smartest trader in the world and that Byron Wien is the greatest investment strategist in modern investment history. Well, maybe Byron's in a tie with Barton Biggs when he was at Morgan Stanley and Lee Cooperman when he was a strategist at Goldman Sachs. Both Byron and Jerry were born of humble beginnings and means. Both are double Harvards, the college and the business school. Both are philanthropic and have given back by committing resources to scholarships for needy Harvard students, among many other endeavors. Byron and Jerry are thoughtful. They don't suffer fools lightly. Both are reflective now that the careers are almost completed. Now, I first met Byron Wien at the first Tuesday of the Month Club in the early 1980s and at Scarsdale Fats' famous Harmony Club luncheons. Scarsdale Fats, also known, his real name is Bob, was immortalized in the late 1960s Adam Smith book, The Money Game. Now, the first Tuesday of the Month Club consisted of a group of amazing investors like Susan Byrne at Westwood, Omega's Lee Cooperman, David Rocker at Rocker Partners, Lou Margolis at Solomon Brothers. And the most interesting one, of course, the bearded prophet of the apocalypse, Michael Steinhardt's head trader, Tony Salufo, a bunch of others. Byron went on to be for 21 years Morgan Stanley's investment strategist, where he was consistently named the number one strategist by Institutional Investor magazine. Now, I would describe Jerry as my primary mentor over my career in investing, along with Larry Lasser and Marty Hale, who are also at Putnam Management in Boston, where I worked. So I guess, Jerry, you can take credit for my rare investment successes, but you also have to bear the responsibility for my numerous investment mistakes. But seriously, I first met Jerry at Putnam in 1974. I was 2 years out of getting an MBA at Wharton. I had been a housing analyst at Kidder Peabody. I was Putnam's financial institutions and conglomerate analyst, and Jerry managed Putnam's aggressive funds. He worked me to the bone. I was obligated, along with his other favorite analyst, Jeff Tabak, who went on to form the most one of the most successful option firm, Miller Tabak, and also became my son's godfather. And Jeff was Putnam's insurance analyst. Jeff and I were mandated to appear at Jerry's desk at the market's close at 3:30 every afternoon. That's where the market closed in the old days, to discuss stocks that both Jeff and I had recommended to him and owned in his personal account. Now, if a stock was down 3/8 of a dollar, remember at that time stocks traded in eighths, I was pummeled by Jerry. Down a dollar, I was in big trouble and I had to buy beers at the Spirits of 76, which was a local Boston bar around the corner from Putnam. So Jerry left Putnam to form the money management firm Hellman Jordan. He delivered extraordinary investment returns for his clients over several decades. His forte was trading, but what I found when working with him at Putnam and in the latter years, when he managed the aggressive mutual funds, is that his unique niche was identifying leading market sectors and then weighting them uber aggressively in keeping with Mae West's line, too much of a good thing could be wonderful. So the format of our 50 minutes will be free form, followed by about 5 or 10 minutes of questions from John's viewers. I encourage both Byron and Jerry to interrupt me and to ask each other questions at any time. Today's session is going to be a lot different than the ones I've listened to so far at SIC. We're not going to debate the merits of asset classes. We're not going to debate the outlook for the global economy and our markets. We won't talk about the dangerous convergence and price distortions of the implementation of modern monetary theory and modern fiscal theory, something that Stan Druckenmiller talked about in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. Rather, my primary objective is for everyone to get into the heads of a wonderful investor and an amazing trader. So I'm going to start with Byron. By you and Jerry, as mentioned, have come from very humble beginnings. Or as my grandma Koufax used to say, you didn't have a pot to piss in. You were orphaned at 14 years old. And my question is, did growing up an orphan make you more hungry to succeed? And secondly, how has Harvard aided your career? What has been the main contribution of your education to your role as a strategist?
Okay. Well, first of all, my life didn't start out without a pot to piss in. My father was a doctor, quite a successful one, but he died when I was 9. And my mother died when I was 14, as you mentioned. But during the time that my father was alive, we lived an ordinary middle-class life. When my mother died, my father had left enough money for food and rent, but not for anything else. So I had to go to work after school. So that's when things were really rough. And, you know, I was only thinking about survival in those days. And I had to figure out some key. And I lived in a middle-class neighborhood where everybody seemed to have a business to go into that their father was in. And I, of course, didn't have that. And so I was concerned how I was going to survive in the future. I realized that going to a great university would be a leg up. That would be helpful to me. And at that time, maybe even today, Harvard was considered the great school of the greatest school in the country. So I applied to Harvard, and or I was encouraged by my high school to apply to Harvard. And a guy from Harvard came through, interviewed me, determined that I had survived a lot of adversity, and his name was John Newman Rowe, and he kind of shepherded me through the process. And Harvard really changed my life. What I got most out of it, Doug, was the ability to think critically. I got that in every classroom, but I was also on the Harvard Crimson, and I was on the editorial board of the Harvard Crimson. And everything that I wrote was posted in a comment book. And other Crimson editors could come and write next to it, whatever their comments were. I remember after I wrote one piece, a guy named Sam Potter wrote next to it, BRW, you were known by your initials. BRW, I always knew you were dumb, but until today, I didn't know how dumb you were. Well, that doesn't happen too often without you doing something to change that opinion. I worked hard to get the most out of Harvard. I knew it was a gift from God, and I got a lot out of my undergraduate career and my 2 years at the business school.
Thanks, bye. Jerry, same question. You came from Revere, Massachusetts. You worked summers shucking clams to pay for your beers. Then you received a full scholarship from the Navy to go to Harvard. So my question is, how much of an incentive to succeed in the investment business emanated from the fact that you started with relatively little in your life? And again, how has Harvard helped your career in investments? And what role did athletics at Harvard play in your trading?
Very interesting question. I was pretty familiar with numbers. And later on in this interview, you're going to ask what I would have liked to have done as a career if I hadn't been an investor. I would have liked to have been an astronomer. I started trading in high school with a math background and an obsession with what makes stocks fluctuate. I began to experiment in projecting targets in stocks with simple geometric progressions. The more that I did this, the more I was able to hone my projections. One of the influences in my investing style is the Italian mathematician Leonardo Fibonacci, whose formulae I utilize technically. Fibonacci retracements and trend lines. Sorry, I'm getting a prompt, sorry. I'm talking about what I was doing while I was at Harvard. I'm getting a coach from you know who. I started investing as a freshman in college. I was successful. By the time I graduated, I had run $200 into $10,000. And then it was time for me to commit my, utilize my commitment and go on into the Navy. I had a four-year commitment, and I decided that I had been so successful trading stocks in college, and I really thought I must have had a great talent for investing, that I left my portfolio as it was and went into the Navy for 4 years. It was worth $10,000 at the time. When I got out of the Navy, it was worth $200. I realized long-term investing at that time was not my forte. At any rate, I became enthralled in the market. And after that, as I just explained, I thought I would have made $10,000, but the portfolio was only worth going back, I became enthralled in the market in high school. I realized that I invested $100 in two OTC stocks, and I lucked out and made about $550 short term. I'm being coached. Sorry.
Let me ask you a question, Jared. Did you were a very good athlete in high school and in Harvard, and Byron was a voracious reader. You think athletes are better traders? And Byron, do you think bookworms are better strategists?
Go ahead, Jerry.
I think athletes are much better traders. They're trained to react very quickly.
I would say that being I don't see how you can do strategy without being a voracious reader. From the time I get up in the morning until I go to bed at night, I'm basically reading all the time.
By what makes for a great strategist, in your words? What has set you apart from your peers?
I'm always looking for something that's different from what's expected. Not necessarily the contrary point of view. Sometimes it's in the direction of the consensus, but just further out. that goes back to when I was a kid. I found a book I started writing at 13. I was a stamp collector then, and the book is about aberrations in published stamps, deviations in the print press or something. So I've always been looking for something that changes the consensus, and I'm doing that to this day.
Jared, there's a universe of literally millions of traders today. More traders today than we've ever had before, with the in part because of the advent of zero commissions. What do you think, in one sentence, has set you apart from your peers?
I'm an aggressive trader. I actually trade a lot. Most investors would disagree with this style or tactic, but ever since commissions diminished, they were no longer a factor in any of my investments or speculations. So I began to trade at a greater volume. As a matter of fact, I have always been reluctant to share specific stock recommendations because I may have bought a stock at market open, but could have liquidated the position before the close.
Right. Hey, Bai?
Yeah.
I think I know the answer, but who has been your greatest influence in your career? And if the answer is Soros, can you explain how you met him and what role he did play, and what's in his DNA that makes him the greatest of all time?
Well, George and I met playing tennis. I wasn't a world-class athlete like Jerry, but I was a reasonable tennis player. And
Define reasonable.
played a lot of tennis together and became friends. And actually, I wrote a book with him in 1995. What separates George is this ability to identify a good idea, and as he would put it, go for the jugular. So he had very concentrated positions. The British pound is a good example. I think Stan Druckenmiller came to him with the idea of putting $1 billion shorting the British pound. And he said, if it's such a good idea, why not do 10 billion on leverage? So concentration is something I learned from George. I also had another mentor, the head of Union Bank Air Privé, Edgar DiPicciotto. He encouraged me to look at new technologies and concentrate in them. And as a result of my friendship with him, I became a big biotech investor. And most of my net worth today is concentrated in biotech stocks. And also, I am the direct opposite of Jerry. So you have a true contrast here. I am a buy and hold investor. I have stocks I've made 10 times, even 100 times my money on that I invested in 30 years ago. That's the greatest tax shelter of all time. May not turn out to be one, but the government not taxing capital appreciation as it comes is a great way to build personal wealth.
By the investment mosaic is very complex these days, especially with the changing structure of the marketplace. If you had to distill your investment equation into three factors, what are those three factors that weigh most heavily in your investment conclusions?
Well, I think you have to understand fiscal and monetary policy, particularly monetary policy, and how that's going to affect the markets. And I would throw in also in that category, you have to have a geopolitical sensitivity because some geopolitical factors like oil or China could play a role. Second, you have to understand profit margins. That is something people don't look at. The companies that have done well, the FANG stocks, have very generous profit margins. And that accounts for their profitability, but also their sustainability and their ability to ward off competition. And then finally, you have to understand sentiment. Because going against sentiment, and Doug, you're a master at this, going against sentiment is the way to build wealth.
Jerry, you just talked about your special trading source. And that to me is the role of mathematics and geometry in your trading. And you distilled your trading world into one name, Fibonacci, also known as Leonardo of Pisa. He was regarded as the most talented Western mathematician of the Middle Ages. So I know very well, speaking to you daily, the role of Fibonacci on your training, but others don't. The thing that gets me with your trading is that Fib numbers, stochastics, charts are available to everyone who's trading. Everyone sees what you're seeing, but there's something that differentiates your trading vision. I know that you look at Fib overlays on individual stocks, as we've discussed, as much as 15 or even 20 times a day. Can you very briefly describe that kind of overlay and technique? Don't make it too complicated, because you confused me about it, so complicated.
Doug, unfortunately, a lot of this is very proprietary, and some of which I choose not to share publicly.
Like the CSJ stochastic?
No, I started experimenting.
With drugs or stocks?
Business. Pardon?
With drugs or stocks?
No.
With drugs or stocks?
Drugs?
No.
I've never even smoked a cigarette.
I know that. That's why I said it.
Funny, huh? No, I started experimenting with real money, and real money is the litmus test. And as I started losing, when I was making mistakes, I learned from a lot of my mistakes, and I adopted a change in my approach. And I found doing a lot of different technical analysis helped me immeasurably.
I noticed that one common theme between you, Jerry, and Byron, and something I've observed since I worked for you in the mid-70s, is that you both have this uncanny ability to isolate the leading market sectors. So, Jerry, I've watched you with CB radio stocks, with RV companies and mobile home stocks, early 80s, the oil stocks. I've seen you put 20, 30, 40% of your portfolio into the savings and loan stocks with my assist as your analyst at Putnam when the weighting was about 1% in the S&P. I saw you buy Moderna when no one knew what Moderna was. Same for Novavax when it was a teenager. I've seen your willingness, once you isolate a leading stock or sector, to really get big in it. And that's something that Byron said often, that Soros said to Druckenmiller often, why put $1 billion in the currency when you can leverage it $10 billion? You take these immense trading positions in stocks or leading sectors. But the most amazing thing to me as a trader, sometimes I've seen, like, for example, with Moderna, and when you were managing the aggressive funds at Putnam, you ride them, and even though they're very volatile. So how do the stocks or the sectors literally come off the page to you?
Well, I thought Moderna was a good idea at the time. And I bought, I think, 211,000 shares at 17 when it came public. I started to cut back when it hit 95. Now, I didn't expect that it would go to 95. I didn't expect we were going to have a plague. Luck is very important in all of this. Now, my wife would say, when I started selling Moderna up there, and then as it went higher, I continued to sell more because that was always my style. I didn't want to give back. And she also began investing in Moderna. And when I cut back, we had a lengthy heated conversation on why did I ever sell anything at 95?
Right, I got you.
She still had her stock, and she still does today. That's the difference between a long-term investor and a trader.
Right. Byron?
Yeah.
You have discussed over the last couple of years the meaningful structural changes in the market, the substantive move from active to passive investing. I wonder how this structural change has influenced your strategic decisions. And should we, as I have written, kill the quants before they kill our markets?
Well, first of all, I believe the movement from active to passive has created opportunities for active investors. When I started out, there were no ETFs. The trading in options was a cult phenomenon, but now options, overlays, various hedging strategies are very much a part of the process. So the business has gotten much more complicated than the old buy and load and hold strategy when I initially start out. Like Jerry, I did a little investing when I was in high school and college, but I was not an active investor until I got out. And even when I got out of business school, I didn't think I'd go into finance. I was out of business school 10 years before a business school classmate invited me to join him on Wall Street. And I didn't do very well the first year in that job and almost got fired. So unlike Jerry, I didn't do it from the beginning. So it was an on-the-job learning process for me from the time I was 30 on. And I didn't get good at it until I was in my 40s. But by that time, the structure of the business had started to change. And it's much more complicated now. But buy and hold still serves me well, identifying great sectors. And all you have to do is understand how the world is changing. And it's changing all the time. And right now you can really see that because it's going to be taken over by millennials. Cyber currencies didn't exist. Cryptocurrencies didn't exist until recently, and they're going to play a role in the market performance going forward.
Thank you, Byron. So now I'm going to play the word association game with Byron and Jerry. I'm going to mention one or two words, and I just want you to respond with one word, totally free form. So Byron, my first word is Amazon. What's your response?
One of the greatest innovators of all time.
Politics.
An impossible way to try to get something done.
Harvard University.
The greatest place in the world to learn critical thinking.
Stanley Druckenmiller.
One of the great investors and one of the most resilient investors, someone willing to change his mind very quickly when he's wrong.
Barton Biggs.
Probably a better writer than he was an investor.
Jerry Jordan Sr.
One of the nicest guys and one of the most talented investors that I ever knew.
He had to say that.
David Portnoy.
This is for Jerry, right?
No, he's that's for you.
He can't.
Do you
answer.
Know who he is? Byron, you still there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. Goldman Sachs.
One of the great investment firms. Very creative in its approach to expanding its business.
Jesse Livermore.
One of the, you know, a fun to read, not necessarily a fun, a useful philosophy to follow.
Okay. Jerry, I got a couple for you.
Amazon. Amazon, he said.
Did you say Amazon?
Yes, sir.
Goliath.
Harvard University.
Life-changing.
Paul Tudor Jones.
Brilliant.
Stan Burge.
Great technician.
Susan Burge.
Like father, like daughter.
Byron Wien.
Grandfather of investing.
Okay, I'm going to end the next 10 or so minutes with a little freeform approach. So Byron and Jerry, you both have had stable personal lives and good marriages. Has that helped you in your business?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. If I had
I trust Anita and Darlene are watching this.
If I had to worry about turbulence at home, I don't think I could do my job. I can concentrate on my job as a result of my home life.
Jerry, I've always said that Darlene is the greatest thing that ever happened to you. Am I right?
Obviously.
She's probably over your shoulder. Secondly, Byron and Jerry, do you think about the markets in your dreams?
Sometimes I do, and a lot of times I don't. I don't dream a lot. I usually dream about very weird things that I can't explain the morning after.
Jerry, do you dream about the markets?
Yes, that is why I don't sleep much.
Maybe you should buy and hold more and trade less, like Byron. Byron and Jerry, what is the role of ego in investing and trading?
Well, I think for a lot of people, it's a big thing because they hold on thinking the decision they made, long or short, is going to be right ultimately. So you've got to get it out of your system early or you won't be a success.
Jerry, the role of ego in trading?
If you don't believe in yourself and have confidence, you'll have a difficult time being successful.
Thank you. Byron, Jerry, I'm going to ask you what your funniest experience has been in your investment career, but I just want to tell a very quick anecdote about Jerry. One day during the CB radio craze, Jerry had a very dear friend, Tommy Wiseau, who owned a West Coast brokerage firm, who's doing an underwriting of a company I believe was called Pathcom. The chairman was speaking at the underwriting luncheon. I was Jerry's analyst, and I didn't know you're not supposed to ask tough questions. I was asking tough questions, and Tom was sitting next to us. The chairman was really arrogant and condescending. So Jerry whispers in my ear, ask the CEO what the implications for the Fletcher-Newman bill currently being proposed in Washington, D.C. is on Pathcom. I asked him. He had no idea, obviously. So he asked the CFO what the ramifications would be on CB manufacturers on that bill. And the CFO, filled with confidence, said there was absolutely no impact. Of course, Jerry made up the name of the bill. We didn't participate in the underwriting. And the stock ultimately went to zero. So I used to visit companies, and the CEOs were particularly arrogant. Remember, Jerry does not, neither does Byron, suffer fools lightly. We use that line often again as a sign that we weren't uninterested in the stock. So Byron and Jerry, what were the funniest experiences in your investment career?
Well, I think humor is a big part of your investment career, but probably the funniest experiences were people I thought didn't respect me that turned out to be so. One of them was Andre Perot, the professor of investment management at Harvard School. Another one was Sam Zell. I thought these two people didn't really buy my act, and both of them later on called upon me to do something for them that indicated that I was wrong. So, you know, I encourage you to believe in yourself and don't be intimidated by the fact that you think that people you respect don't have respect for you. They probably do, and you don't know it.
Jerry, any funny experiences you want to share?
I think you just did with the Fletcher Newman bill.
Okay. If Jerry answered this question, Byron, but I want you to answer it. If you had a different career, what do you think you would have enjoyed and would have been successful at?
Well, you know, I was always thought of as a good writer in college, and people encouraged me to pursue that as a career. But, and I was going through my Hemingway period then, and I thought it would be great to go to Paris, sit in the garret, and write the great American novel. But I thought it would be lonely also, and I decided I probably couldn't earn a living. Happily, in my college class was John Updike, and he was clearly a much better writer than I was. So I decided I had to earn a living some other way. But that would have been my alternative.
Byron, who is your favorite strategist or thinker today?
I think I learned and continue to learn a lot from Lee Cooperman.
Jerry, who's your favorite technician that has influenced you?
Greatest technician. Bob Farrell.
Good answer. Byron, have you been successful because of your hard work or your intellect?
I work very hard. So I would say my work ethic is much more. I don't think I'm all that smart, honestly. But I have enough brains so that if I couple it with working hard, I can be successful.
Chair, I asked this to you yesterday. Is the thrill of winning better than the depression of losing in trading?
Are you kidding? Winning.
Byron, do you live to work or do you work to live?
I live to work. I'm a decade or so older than Jerry. I'm still doing it. I don't need to do it in terms of money. I could still put three meals on the table without working, but I love what I do, and so I'm going to keep doing it as long as I can.
More power to you.
Bye. For 18 years, I've been taking your idea, and I produced my own list of surprises on thestreet.com with Jim Cramer. Are you angry at me being a copycat? And also,
no,
how would you grade my list?
I'm thrilled that you do it. And other people have done it too. And there are people who do it in individual sectors. I've seen that. So the more copying is a compliment, I encourage you to keep on doing it. Your doing it enhances my product, creates more interest in my product. And so I've never been in any way arguing that you should stop.
Okay, we have about five more minutes, guys, so just bear with me. I'm a big baseball fan, and Babe Ruth once wrote that every strike brings me closer to the next home run. Do mistakes bring rewards? And what have you guys learned from your mistakes? Byron?
I always, you know, view mistakes. I try to learn from my mistakes, but I don't know that I do. I learn more from my hits from my homers than I do from my strikeouts. But usually the strikeout is because I followed somebody else's advice, and the homers are because I listened to my own demons. So when I act independently, I usually am more successful than when I act with the crowd.
And how do you learn, Jerry, from your mistakes?
It's almost a daily lesson.
You see it in your P&L.
Yeah.
Two more questions. Jerry and Byron, we have to talk about Bitcoin and digital currency for a second. And with apologies to my friend Mark Yusko, who is a big Bitcoin bull, I want you to respond to my view of cryptocurrency. Over, I guess, 2 weekends ago at Berkshire Hathaway's annual meeting, Warren Buffett said he had $145.6 billion in cash and nothing in Bitcoin. To me, the problem with fiat currencies is like the US dollar. Monetary authorities can create an unlimited amount of new dollars or other currencies, making it look to some like a Ponzi scheme. The problem with cryptocurrencies, as I see it, like Ethereum and Bitcoin, is that anyone can make an unlimited number of new cryptocurrencies, making it too look to some like a Ponzi scheme. Ponzi schemes and scams are only visible to those that have no sense of history or want to believe in magic. I believe that digital currency, as structured today, is sort of like Tinkerbell's light. Its power source is based solely on enough children believing in it. How do you feel about Bitcoin, Byron and Jerry?
I have spent a lot of time, like you have, Doug, trying to get my arms around Bitcoin. I haven't, I don't own any Bitcoin. I've been on the brink of buying a few times, but I finally decided that I don't need it to preserve my wealth. I would only own Bitcoin the way I have cash, and it isn't like cash. It's too volatile to be cash. So right now, I'm not changing that policy. I don't need it to function. I don't need it to invest. I think it's dangerous, but I know it's being embraced broadly across the investment environment.
What about you, Jerry? You like these two old fossils who are non-consensus Bitcoin bears?
Well, I think I have to join Byron in most of his beliefs about Bitcoin. I have a son who believes in Bitcoin, and I watch him trade in it or invest in it, and I shall remain aloof and watch him. And if he shows me a succession of wins, I'll start to listen. But right now, when I seek another investment area, I go to gold, so long as it's sold off.
So we have 7 minutes left. Before we go into the questions, I really want to thank two really wonderful people that I give back to society, Byron and Jerry, for doing this. I know, Jerry, you do this about every four decades, which means you'll be doing it in four decades from now. And I hope we sort of illuminated what's in a strategist's mind, what he thinks about, what's in a trader's mind, and the convergence of investing and trading. So let me throw it back to John or Ed for questions.
Brian, I can't hear them. Am I being heard?
Yes.
Okay, because I went radio silent there for the last 30 seconds. We've got a few questions and from the audience, and I've got some questions for you, Doug, that I want Byron and Jerry to respond to. Let's go to the ones with you. you've been in Fuego. You've been on fire lately. Actually, we'll tell the audience. I mean, you did an initial paper with Ralph Nader. You are a well-known, progressive Democrat. But you have been very critical of the increased spending, of running the deficits and the debt up. You're very concerned about some of the unemployment and the Fed and the government moving into the markets and taking control, which I found it resonated with me. And as a 10-year consumer of your writing, it's kind of at odds of what you've been doing. What do you feel about the current macro environment of the government fiscal spending and the government monetary policy? And I'd like to ask all three of you guys, how do you think that plays into markets? I mean, is there a risk?
I am a progressive Democrat, but I am now concerned about the convergence of what is called modern monetary theory with what I call modern fiscal theory. And the core of my concern is getting back to Jerry's mathematics. Two decades ago, the national debt in this country was under $5 trillion. It is now approaching $29 trillion. That means 100 basis point impact on debt servicing 20 years ago has the impact of only 18 or 20 basis point increase today. So that means we are in an incendiary situation, well described by Stan Druckenmiller in his op-ed in the Wall Street Journal and his interview on CNBC yesterday. It really could be incendiary if non-vigilantes, for the first time in three decades.
By incendiary, do you mean inflationary?
Inflationary rates could ratchet much higher, and I'm extremely concerned, despite my political leanings.
Byron, same question to you.
Yeah, I'm in the same camp. I'm very worried about it. I think there were some inflation numbers that came out today that encouraged me to believe that we're headed to inflation between 3% and 4%, and a 10-year Treasury yield close to 3%. And when it gets above 3% into the fours, I think it could be a fiscal problem, putting a big burden on the budget deficit. So I'm very worried about what's going on and its implication for the equity market.
Jerry?
I would mention, John, you might see Jerry's head turning to his Quotron screen. He is a true trader.
I actually knew what he was doing. When Byron started talking, Jerry starts looking at his quote. So, yes. Go ahead, Jerry.
Forget about this cosmic stuff. Where is Coinbase trading at?
No. What I peeked at was to see what the NASDAQ was doing and also what the 10-year Treasury was doing.
And?
It's not good. I think it's very dangerous.
Okay.
For people who are long equities.
Okay. Do you think all three of you, starting with you, Doug, should the Fed start leaning into this? They're telling us that they're not going to do anything for 32 months. The markets, at least on the upper end of treasuries, the inflationary numbers are coming in big. Should the Fed start walking back their promise for 32 months of zero rates?
I think they should, but to me, the damage has already been done, John.
Byron?
Yeah, I definitely think they should stop the $120 billion of buying. They're still putting too much money into the system, And that's not having a positive effect. That's pushing up equities and keeping bond yields down.
But we learned back in the 70s that you can't keep pushing on that string forever. 30 more seconds, Ed, and I'll let you, because, we're actually running out of time. Doug, last comment. You got 10 seconds. Besides, thank you.
Thank you very much, as always.
You guys have been awesome. We've got a special announcement coming up. We'll turn it over to Mr. SIC himself, Ed D'Agostino.